staggering 57.26% didn't work. The trend line was somewhat better among women, around 44%. If OxyContin was the new moonshine in rural America, disability was the new factory work. By 2016, for every unemployed American man between the ages of 22 and 55, an additional 3 were neither working nor looking for work. Having dropped out of the workforce entirely, they had numerically vanished from the kind of monthly job reports touted by politicians and reporters. Many turned up instead in disability statistics, which were largely ignored in headline-grabbing economic reports. Disability claims nearly doubled from 1996 to 2015. The federal government spent an estimated $192 billion on disability payments in 2017 alone, more than the combined total for food stamps, welfare, housing subsidies, and unemployment assistance. For people who have not ventured recently into rural America, the jaw-dropping, invisible decline of work comes as a shocker, an outgrowth of the nation's widening political and cultural divide. Before the 2016 election of Donald Trump, that disconnect was maintained by a national media that paid little attention to rural, predominantly white places like St. Charles or Bassett, where the country's much-hailed economic recovery had definitely not trickled down. At the same time, it had never been within the purview of local papers like the Martinsville Bulletin to investigate what was happening with international trade in Washington or New York, much less the latest push by Big Pharma or global drug cartels. And regional newspapers like my own Roanoke Times had drastically shrunk their coverage to a mainly urban and suburban core, ignoring the increasingly distressed communities in our hinterlands just when reporting on those places was needed the most. Those of us living highly curated and time-strapped lives in cities across America, predominantly mixing virtually and physically with people whose views echoed our own, had no idea how politically and economically splintered our nation had become, and also how much poorer and sicker and work-starved the already struggling parts of the nation truly were, because we didn't follow that story. We may feel more connected by our cell phones and computers, but in reality, we are more divided than ever before. In the mid-sized city where I live, OxyContin continued to be viewed as a rural problem into the early 2010s, a problem in the coal fields some 4 hours to the west. While the Roanoke Times covered the 2007 sentencing hearing of Purdue Pharma executives, it rarely mentioned OxyContin after that. We in Roanoke had heard opioid abuse was seeping into distressed factory towns like those in Henry County, but very rarely did our newspaper report on it. We were safe in our ignorance, or so we thought, content to stereotype drug addiction as the affliction of jobless hillbillies, a small group of inner-city blacks, and a few misguided suburban kids. But another invisible hand was upon us. Heinrich Dresser's drug moved seamlessly across city and county lines with zero regard for politics, race, neighborhood, or class. I didn't understand the connection between rural poverty, disability, and opioid addiction until I learned more about the accidental Bassett furniture arsonist. Turned out he'd arrived at his copper heist on the outskirts of Bassett on his bicycle, a rare sight in the rolling foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. He was one of the unemployed masses. He did not have a paying job, said the prosecutor, who's now a judge, in the case. But his crime actually required work, so he wasn't lazy so much as he was desperate. Like so many of the region's petty thieves, the arsonist was propelled by fear of becoming dope sick, added another local prosecutor, who told me that 75% of all police calls in the county now involved heroin or methamphetamine or increasingly a combination of both. Not only were rates of unemployment, disability, and opioid addiction soaring, but there was also renewed interest in methamphetamines and the practice of switching between opioids in the form of either pills or their much cheaper cousin, heroin, and meth. Crystal meth controls all the dockets now in rural Virginia, a local drug task force officer told me. If you're addicted to painkillers, he said, you become so lethargic you can hardly function. But meth keeps you going if you need to run the streets to go get your next dose of heroin or pills, to keep you from getting sick. It allows you to function. There's a reason they call it high-speed chicken feed. I thought immediately of Spencer Mumpower's 2010 jail mugshot. So much separated Spencer, whose mother had sent him to private school and then paid for 15 different rehabs, from the man who stripped copper wire out of the abandoned furniture factory. A scrawny junkie with sunken eyes and sticky-out collarbones, as Spencer described himself to me in 2012, he said, "I looked ridiculous, like I had chicken pox, like I'd stuck my head down a groundhog's lair." But I had failed, just as the police and the parents had, to connect young adults like Spencer to the rural addicted, even though Spencer told me he'd come to his heroin addiction the same way they had, through prescription opioid pills. Our culture seems to excuse drug and other risk-taking in white middle and upper-middle-class kids, especially young men. The same liberties, when taken by rural poor whites or people of color, wherever they live, come across as more desperate, born of fundamental wants or needs that can't be satisfied. But as I've come to learn, gauged strictly by drug use, there is no less urgency and desperation in America's middle and upper classes today. Drug epidemics unfold like a vector phenomenon, where you have one individual who seeds the community and then the spread begins, said Dr. Anna Lemke, an addiction medicine specialist at the Stanford University School of Medicine and the author of the book Drug Dealer MD. People whose parents or grandparents were drug or alcohol addicted have dramatically increased odds of becoming addicted themselves, with genetics accounting for 50 to 60% of that risk, Lemke explained. She noted that the correlation between family history and depression is much lower, 30%. Other risk factors for addiction include poverty, unemployment, multigenerational trauma, and access to drugs. She said, "It's important to note it's really not just the unemployed and the poor who are vulnerable today. It's really everybody, especially under-challenged youths or youths who aren't engaged in school or other meaningful activities." At the age of 13, Spencer had stolen 5 bottles of painkillers, more than halfway full. There were leftovers prescribed to different relatives in the aftermath of routine outpatient surgeries. By 14, he was taking pills regularly. Back then, he used saved-up lunch money to buy weed, which he then traded for ADHD medications prescribed to his friends, or for OxyContin pilfered from their parents' medicine chests. In his Hidden Valley subdivision, full of sprawling ranches, trim colonial two-stories, and arts and crafts bungalows that were new but meant to look old, heroin was easier to get. "When we first started doing it, we didn't even worry about getting caught because cops didn't know what heroin even looked like," he said. "One time, I got pulled over, I had 10 bags at my feet, and they didn't know what it was, so they didn't look at it." In rural America, the opioid epidemic aged into a wily adolescence in the aughts. In the hinterlands of Virginia, it had tended to pull in families. "We'd sometimes have one overdose where the son would die, then the next day the father would die, then the next day the mother would die," the Roanoke-based medical examiner said. "If it had been an infectious disease, there would have been widespread panic." Then Virginia Tech researcher Martha Wunsch remembered the moment she went from studying overdose deaths in rural counties, funded by a National Institutes of Health grant, to hearing about it from her own teenagers who went to high school with Spencer and Scott Roth. State health officials in Richmond had originally dismissed her research, telling her the same thing they'd said to Sue Cantrell, the rural health department director. "This is a regional problem," they said. "The issue is Interstate 81, Wunsch told me. The OxyContin epidemic spread from where she called East Nowhere Jesus all up and down the Appalachian chain by way of the interstate. And suddenly," she said, "my own kids were coming home from parties talking about pills being passed around in bowls." Opioids infiltrated the toniest suburbs, not by way of families, but by peer groups. The new suburban users didn't come to the attention of police until roughly around the time Purdue Pharma launched its 2010 abuse-resistant version of the drug, at the same time Spencer handed Scott Roth the heroin that led to his death, 14 years after OxyContin was introduced. In Roanoke, the urban hub for the western half of the state, I-81 perches at the edge of the northern suburbs. It rolls and undulates, connecting western Appalachian communities from Tennessee to Virginia as it travels northeast around Roanoke and up through the northern Shenandoah Valley, intersecting with other interstates leading to Baltimore and Washington, New Jersey, and New York. One of the most segregated cities in the South, Roanoke had long had a steady but largely quiet group of heroin users in its urban core, which positioned it to become an ideal transfer station for the region's transition from dope to pills, then back to dope. It was a perfect incubator for the opioid epidemic, a cultural and geographic crossroads. It was big enough for users to easily forge drug connections and yet small enough for the drug dealers to hide out. Some dealers, traditionally ensconced in the city's poorest northwest quadrant, were beginning to migrate to the more affluent neighborhoods of Hidden Valley and Cave Spring, one heroin task officer told me, to avoid robberies and home invasions. As long as it was in the lower economic classes and marginalized groups like musicians and people of ethnic minorities, it was okay because it was with those people, said Spencer's counselor, Vinnie Dabney, an African-American who took his first sniff from a bag of heroin his sophomore year of high school in 1968 and was a mostly functioning user for 30 years. Needle-phobic, he never once shot up. Back then, you could maintain that way because the drug's potency was low, 3-7%, compared with 40-60% today. And the police paid little attention since white kids in the suburbs weren't dying or nodding out in the football bleachers. Dabney said, but the moment it crossed those boundary lines from the inner city into the suburbs, it became a, quote, epidemic. After two drug-related jail stints, he left court-ordered treatment in the late 1990s to get a master's in counseling and now works as a mental health and substance abuse counselor who leads support groups for users taking the maintenance drug buprenorphine, or BUP, more commonly known by the brand name Suboxone. Dabney said, it's ludicrous, this thing that's been knocking on your door for over 100 years, and you've ignored it until finally it's like a battering ram taking your doors off the hinges. It's a monster now, but nobody paid any attention to it until their cars were getting robbed and their kids were stealing their credit cards. The worst of it, Dabney warned, was that people were getting hooked at even younger ages and making the switch faster from pills to heroin. It took a while for the force of the battering ram to register. Unlike in the coal fields where addicted users quickly resorted to thievery to fund their next fix, in the suburbs the epidemic spread stealthily because users had ready access to money. Many of them were teenagers selling electronic devices, then telling their parents they'd been stolen, or raiding their college savings accounts, or simply using their allowance. They were not engaging in spot and steal, not trading a mule for 4 pills, not wheeling stolen garden tillers down the street for everyone to see. In the wealthiest Roanoke County suburbs, illicit pill-taking commenced, shared on true green lawns, next to school lockers, and in carpeted basements, while clueless parents in Cave Spring and Hidden Valley were making family dinners upstairs. There was no widespread panic because the teenagers and young adults had the money to keep their addictions at a low boil. And those parents who were in on the dirty little secret were too ashamed to let the neighbors know. From California to Florida, the parents behind Relatives Against Purdue Pharma already knew that OxyContin stood out more in rural America's distressed hollows and towns, where reps could easily target the lowest hanging fruit, the injured jobless and people on disability with Medicaid cards. But OxyContin was everywhere, of course, and it had been almost since the beginning, even if the crimes associated with it hadn't dominated the urban news. The early suburban waves mostly stayed hidden because parents there could afford to put their kids in a 30- or 60-day program, said Dr. Hughes Melton, an addiction specialist and now the Virginia Department of Health's chief deputy commissioner overseeing much of the state's response to the crisis. You really didn't hear much about it until young people started dying, Melton said. It was the death of the funny young rapping chef, Scott Roth, with his mop of blonde hair and life-of-the-party disposition that should have put the Roanoke region on notice. The weekend when most of his friends were going off to college, his mother had driven him to a rehab program at the local rescue mission. She remembers leaving him by the mission door in the rain, in his plaid shorts and Nautica shirt. Spencer Mumpower helped me unpack the epidemic as it unfolded behind mall movie theaters and in wooded cul-de-sacs in the late aughts. But even though high school surveys showed suburban heroin use was growing in 2012, it was then 3% higher in Roanoke County schools than the national average. Parents and prevention workers alike underestimated Spencer's warnings, viewing his crime as an anomaly, maybe even an outlier case of bad parenting. We didn't understand the connection between heroin and pills at least until 2014, admitted Nancy Hans, an area drug prevention coordinator. In 2010, her prevention council of Roanoke County initiated drug takebacks, events where citizens were encouraged to safely dispose of unused medications, but she wishes now that she had singled out opioids. At the urging of local police, Hans instead launched a campaign to warn parents about synthetic bath salts in 2012, then in the public eye because they had caused bizarre behavior, including physical scuffles with police, as well as the overdose deaths of two local young women. Shortly after President Obama signed a law banning the sale of the products, Vice magazine swooped into Roanoke for a scoop. Looking back, the bath salts blight was a red herring, problematic but short-lived, and a distraction from a much quieter, even deadlier drug. "That's how it all got way out in front of us," Han said. "And the doctors didn't see their role in it either. When a doctor prescribed our teenagers 30 Percocet pills for a pulled wisdom tooth, we didn't know to complain. It was like we were all in a big fog of denial," she said. Within 5 years, Hans would have the numbers of multiple mothers of addicted kids programmed into her cell phone. She would find herself rushing from the funerals of heroin overdose 20-somethings to giving prevention talks in the auditoriums of the high schools they once attended. Spencer's masterclass in drug abuse had gone unheeded, boxed away into a category of things that happened to other families. Andrew Basford, the assistant U.S. attorney who prosecuted Spencer's case, took an angry phone call from the Roanoke County school superintendent, who was mad that he'd openly addressed the accessibility of heroin and OxyContin in her schools. "How dare you tell the newspaper those things?" the superintendent seethed. Basford, who also works as a brigadier general in the U.S. Army Reserve, was unmoved by her scolding. "I say these things because I know them to be true," he said. "Your schools are a pit because your students have money, and money attracts drugs." The Hidden Valley teenagers called the green 80-milligram oxys green goblins. They scored them from an array of sources, a restaurant co-worker, a brother who'd had them prescribed in the wake of wisdom tooth surgery, an Iraq War veteran who had legitimate pain but was prescribed twice as many pills as he needed and funneled the rest to the kids down the street in exchange for cash. "Parents didn't really know what was going on when it was just pills," recalled Victoria, not her real name, who tried her first OxyContin pill her senior year after a friend ratted her out to school officials for smoking weed. Victoria remembered the first time she tried to crush an abuse-resistant Oxy, following Purdue's long-awaited reformulation in 2010, and it worked exactly as Barbara Van Rooyen envisioned it would when she petitioned the FDA, demanding an opioid blocker or antagonist be added to the drug. Victoria said, "If you tried to crunch them, they'd gel up on you. You couldn't even snort them, let alone shoot them. After that, the pills either went dry or were just too expensive to get, and everybody who used to deal pills started dealing heroin instead," she said. "I noticed another, lesser-known pattern among the addicted suburbanites I interviewed. The green goblins were typically preceded by a starter pack of a very different drug. Almost to a person, the addicted 20-somethings I met had taken attention deficit medication as children, prescribed pills that as they entered adolescence morphed from study aid to party aid. On college campuses, Ritalin and Adderall were not just a way to pull an all-nighter for the physics exam, never mind that they were prescribed to your roommate, not you. They also allowed a person to drink alcohol for hours on end without passing out. That made them a valuable currency, tradable for money and or other drugs. Between 1991 and 2010, the number of prescribed stimulants increased tenfold among all ages, with prescriptions for attention deficit disorder drugs tripling among school-age children between 1990 and 1995 alone. and we're prescribing to ever and ever younger children, some kids as young as 2 years old, said Lemke, the addiction researcher. It's just nuts, she said, because if we really believe that addiction is a result of changes in the brain due to chronic heavy drug exposure, how can we believe that stimulant exposure isn't going to change these kids' brains in a way that makes them more vulnerable to harder drugs, she added. The science is far from clear, according to a 2014 data review. Some studies show that ADHD-diagnosed children treated with stimulants have lower rates of addiction to some substances than those who weren't medicated, while other studies suggest that exposure to stimulants in childhood can lead to addiction in adulthood. A lot of us think the doctors have overdiagnosed children with ADHD, so a diagnosis is something to very carefully discern, and parents should always monitor the medications their children and teenagers are on, said Sherry Hartman, a Roanoke psychologist. Lemke pins the opioid epidemic not just on physician overprescribing fueled by Big Pharma, but also on the broader American narrative that promotes all pills as a quick fix. Between 1998 and 2005, the abuse of prescription drugs increased a staggering 76%. While opioids have resulted in the direst consequences, Lemke is equally leery of benzodiazepines, prescribed for anxiety, and stimulants, both of which make teenagers, especially under-challenged kids who aren't engaged in meaningful activities, dangerously comfortable with the notion of taking pills. Any pills. Whether the pills originated in a bottle with their name on it or came from a bowl at a so-called farm party. Emergency room administrator Dr. John Burton watched the cultural shift play out at the North Carolina YMCA summer camp he attended as a kid and returned to later as a camp doctor. Whereas very few campers took prescribed medications in the 1970s, by the mid-90s, 10% were taking a pill at some point during the day. Most for asthma or allergy conditions, followed by a small subset of kids on behavioral medications, usually for ADHD. By 2012, fully one-third of his campers were on meds, mostly ADHD medications, antidepressants, and antipsychotics. He said, "What happens is we've changed our whole culture from one where kids don't take pills at all to one where you've got a third or more of kids who are on pills to stay well because of what are believed to be chronic health conditions," Burton said. They get so used to taking pills that eventually they end up using them for a recreational high. So it went that young people barely flinched at the thought of taking Adderall to get them going in the morning, an opioid painkiller for a sports injury in the afternoon, and a Xanax to help them sleep at night, many of the pills doctor prescribed. So it went that 2/3 of college seniors reported being offered prescription stimulants for non-medical use by 2012 from friends, relatives, and drug dealers. In the short term, Anne Lemke said, kids and parents and even teachers may feel better about Adderall's ability to enhance memory and attention, but studies show that over the long term, those kids don't do any better in school than people who don't receive stimulants. And among those whose stimulant usage becomes a gateway to harder drugs, they're doing much worse. That was true for Spencer Mumpower, who routinely traded Adderall for marijuana and Ritalin for cocaine. That was true for almost every addicted young adult I interviewed for this book. As Spencer prepared for prison in the fall of 2012, the remainder of the Hidden Valley group with whom he'd abused drugs kept on as usual to avoid becoming dope sick. Whether that meant recruiting new users at parties or taking jobs at senior moving companies with the express intent of stealing opioids from retirees, targeting the expired or leftover prescriptions so the client wouldn't notice. If it was a current medication, I'd take just a couple, recalled a recovering heroin user I'll call Brian, then a Hidden Valley high school student, a doctor's son, and a member of the marching band. Brian said, "If it was an old prescription, I'd take the whole bottle. Some old people would tell me, just throw it away, and I'd definitely take those." Dependent on pills by age 17, Brian was 20 when a coworker introduced him to heroin. He snorted it first from wax paper bags marked Colombian Coffee and Blue Magic, in wrappers so small he could hide them inside his cell phone case. "From the moment I did that first bag, I can tell you, looking back now, it was destined," he said. After snorting the crushed up oxys, inhaling the heroin powder was easy, and the heroin was cheaper, more intense, and increasingly, it was everywhere Brian went. Though he was deeply troubled by Scott Ross' death, little else but drugs mattered anymore. Another friend taught him how to inject himself. He bought the needles at a local drugstore, telling the pharmacist he needed them for insulin. "It was like shooting Jesus up in your arm," Brian said of his first IV injection. "It's like this white explosion of light in your head. You're floating on a cloud. You don't yet know that the first time is the best. After that, you're just chasing that first high." Within 6 months, Brian had blown through the $8,000 he'd put aside for college and pawned his Xbox and video games, all without his parents' knowledge. He told me, "I would spend 6 hours a day driving around Roanoke picking up drugs, waiting for phone calls, going to ATMs." His parents noticed he was moodier than usual and worried about his weight loss. He'd dropped from 150 to 125 pounds. They asked him if he was anorexic. A counselor he was seeing for anxiety set up an intervention of sorts in his office, inviting Brian's parents to attend and beginning with, "Brian wants to tell you about a problem he's having." By then, he was shooting up 20 bags a day, buying them from a host of user dealers that had once included Spencer and Scott. Brian told his parents, "I'm addicted to heroin." And while they were relieved to finally know why he'd lost so much weight and why he sometimes stayed out until 3 or 4 a.m., they were also gobsmacked. They sent him to a local hospital to detox, then to intensive outpatient treatment, where he was prescribed the opioid maintenance drug Suboxone, with mandatory urine screenings, one-on-one counseling, and support group meetings. Brian was 23 years old and beginning to wean off Suboxone when I first interviewed him in 2012. He said, "It's been 7 days today since his last dose. I have pinprickly skin and I'm restless. It's hard to sit still." Still mourning Scott's death, he noted that none of his other user dealer friends, with the exception of Spencer, had been caught. "The cell phone is the glue that holds it all together for the modern drug user," Brian told me. "In high school, I snuck out of the house a number of times to meet people at the bottom of the driveway, and my parents had no clue. Aside from taking my cell phone away, my parents also could have looked at my text message logs and gotten a sense of what was going on," he said. At a Lutheran church on the outskirts of Hidden Valley, two moms of opioid-addicted young men met at a Families Anonymous meeting where worried parents go for peer support. Not only would their chance meeting have lasting implications for families of the addicted in the region, but their stories would also expose how families operate inside the sizable gaps that have opened up between the two institutions tasked with addressing the opioid epidemic, the criminal justice and healthcare systems. While shame too often cloaks these gaps in secrecy, some doctors, drug dealers, and pharmaceutical companies continue to profit mightily from them. The addicted work to survive and stave off dope sickness, while desperate family members and volunteers work to keep them alive. Jamie Waldrop was a civic leader, the wife of a prominent surgeon. Drina Banks and her husband ran a successful insurance agency. Their sons had been friends and used drugs together, crossing paths briefly through friends at North Cross, a private suburban school that Jamie's son Christopher attended. Drina recalled, "I just knew Jamie was this cool, blonde-haired chick who was making me laugh at a time when I needed to laugh." Jamie had not one but two children who'd become addicted, first to pills, then heroin. She hadn't realized the depth of their addiction until she found them both passed out in separate incidents in her home. Her oldest, breathing but slumped over in a chair from a combo of Xanax and painkillers, his cell phone fallen to the ground. Her youngest passed out and naked on the bathroom floor, heroin needles and blood sprawled around him. Between the outpatient Suboxone programs, none of which worked, the family said, and multiple residential rehabs and aftercare sober house programs, two of which eventually did, the Waldrops would spend more than $300,000 on treatment, not counting the drug-related legal fees or the thousands in stolen checks and credit card bills for gift cards, which were traded to dealers for drugs. "A $200 gift card goes for $120 worth of pills," Jamie explained. "Christopher, her youngest, told me I was a pretty bad robber." Jamie and her husband can't pinpoint the most frenzied moment in their journey. Maybe it was when they were scheduled to attend a medical conference at the Greenbrier, a storied 5-star resort, but had to bring their grown sons along because they couldn't trust them to stay home alone. Before the conference was over, they discovered a sizable drug stash hidden in a potted plant in their room. Maybe it was when Jamie's surgeon husband had to drive to the roughest part of the city to pay off one son's drug dealer debt. Or maybe it was the daily jewelry shuffle Jamie initiated in the wake of discovering her diamond necklace gone, along with her husband's Rolex. She'd take what remained of her best jewelry, the handed-down stuff, and rotate it between an oatmeal container, the freezer, and the dirty laundry hamper, the last places her children would look. "We lived like that for years," she said. "It was our new normal. Until they go off to rehab, you don't realize just how dysfunctional your life has become." In the beginning, Jamie and Drina, like most parents, isolated themselves, until it dawned on them at the family's anonymous meeting that they were living a very similar nightmare. "I stayed away from my other friends because what do you say when people ask you, 'How are your kids doing?'" Jamie said. Christopher was 2 weeks into his first residential treatment stay when word reached him that a good friend had fatally overdosed on 30 milligram oxycodone pills and other narcotics. It was Colton Banks, Drina's son. "It tore me up pretty good," Christopher remembered. "Colton was the nicest guy ever. You could call him up in the middle of the night and ask him for a ride, and he'd get out of bed and come and get you." Christopher recognized the location of his friend's death immediately. His body was found at the home of a middle-aged man, an opioid addict who'd been prescribed hundreds of the pills from a Roanoke pain clinic 3 days before. All but 12 of the pills were missing, a police search warrant confirmed, in a painkiller-selling scheme that placed Colton, 19, on the campus of Radford University, where he was selling the pills to pay back a drug debt from the day before. "We got most of our pills from him," Christopher said of the middle-aged addict. "He'd get 430s, roxycodone, then some 15s, also roxycodone, Xanax and Klonopin, all prescribed to him at once by the same crooked doctor. You can use a lot and still make $5,000 a month off that, if not more." The weekend of Colton's death was supposed to be his last hurrah before getting clean. He had an appointment with an addiction specialist lined up for Monday. He'd stuck not one but two post-it notes on the dashboard of his car reminding him to go. Colton died at 11:30 on the morning of November 4, 2012, All Saints Sunday, while his parents were in church. A few hours later, when a policeman showed up on their stoop to say that Colton had expired, they were initially confused. Expired? No, Colton was dead. To add insult, no charges were filed against the middle-aged dealer, because it's impossible to pin blame on a single batch of pills when an autopsy rules multiple toxicity, as it did in Colton's case, the police chief confirmed. The Bankses fumed, then and now, about that. "I want to go kill the bastard," Drina told her husband, but he persuaded her to stop and think about their other son. And she did, though she sometimes sat outside the man's house in her car, her gun on the seat next to her, anguishing and hating and praying for her son. 2 years before Colton's death, a family friend in Fredericksburg, Virginia, lost his son to a heroin overdose, and Drina remembered thinking, "Why can't you control your kid?" She apologized later for having judged. She had monitored Colton's Adderall when she learned he was abusing it at age 17. She'd grounded him soon after when she found pot hidden in a briefcase under his bed. She'd sent him to a 28-day rehab at 19 after he progressed to pills. "At first, you're just so embarrassed," Drina said. "You think you're doing right as a parent, but then these drugs take over their life, and nobody talks about it because it's this dark, hidden secret." At the funeral home visitation, Drina had Colton presented in an open casket, wearing a flannel shirt she just bought him from Kohl's, pants, hat, and his favorite boots, the ones he wore four-wheeling. His hands were arranged so they clutched a necklace he'd recently borrowed from his older brother, a silverfish medallion with the inscription WWJD. She remembered her handsome bearded boy borrowing it from his brother's nightstand, telling her, "I may not be as good looking as Kevin, but I do pretty well with the girls," and they both laughed. She would remember that moment every day for the rest of her life, especially when she stopped by Burger King on his birthday to order his favorite meal, a cheeseburger with fries and sweet tea, and when she poured dressing on her salad. She remembered he'd use ranch and he'd think the bottle had a small hole in it when it didn't, and invariably it'd go all over the place. I wanted his friends to see this person they knew who was no longer here. This was the star athlete, the kid who stood up to bullies. Colton was everybody's protector, everybody's friend. He had a good home life. He really had it all, she recalled, tearing up. They think they're invincible. 3 months after Spencer left for prison, and 2 years after Scott Roth's death, the Bankses used their 19-year-old son's funeral to send a message to his opioid-addicted friends and their parents. Though Christopher Waldrop was away at rehab and not allowed to come home, Jamie made a point of sitting next to one of his high school friends at the service in an increasingly familiar role. She and a handful of other local moms were preparing to out themselves and their families, understanding, finally, that survival had to trump shame. Jamie pledged to help her son's friend find a bed at a treatment facility the moment he was ready to go. His parents were in total denial, she said. She would tell Christopher later how Drina Banks stood at her son's funeral, her voice quavering, and begged her audience to let Colton's death be the last. At the funeral, Drina said, "For the longest time, I didn't know what God wanted me to do, but now I know," she told the mourners, chucking her prepared marks in favor of an impromptu call for treatment. "There are so many families struggling with the same thing Colton has been struggling with. It's insidious, and it's evil, and it's not just pot, and I know there's a social stigma attached to this, but don't hide. Don't hide from it. I know there are at least 3 other boys here that I know Colton wants me to help, and you know who you are. I know now that I'm supposed to be here for you boys, and we're going to make it through." The following Mother's Day, Jamie called Drina and asked her to come over because her husband was out of the country and she didn't know what else to do. Christopher was close to relapsing, Jamie suspected, if he hadn't already. He was at home visiting her, having checked himself out of an Asheville, North Carolina aftercare program against his counselor's advice. "After 4 months of sobriety," he told me later, "I was tired of all the rules. I wanted to drink again." Jamie begged Drina to talk some sense into her son, and Drina tried. She told him that Colton would not want him to be using again, that it wasn't fair for his mom to have to wonder every second of every day if she would be going to his funeral as she did Colton's. He insisted that he wasn't using heroin and that he hoped eventually to make Colton proud. But the drinking would lead to poor choices, as it usually did, and before long the usual signs presented themselves in the form of stolen checks and pawned laptops, and Christopher continuing to lie through his teeth to his mom over the phone from Asheville that he was not doing drugs. Drina advised Jamie to drive the 4 hours to her son's apartment and show up on his doorstep, unannounced. "You've got to go down there," she implored her friend. "You've got to go look at him and pull up his sleeves." Jamie arrived at her son's apartment to find cases of beer and a bong in the middle of the living room. "Hand me your phone," she said. Her stomach sank the moment she clicked on his text log and found scores of messages to and from drug dealers. There was no need to pull up Christopher's sleeves. The needles and bags of heroin were right there near the beer, tucked into his shoes. Christopher remembered, "I was like, shit, here we go again." What he needed, said his counselor, whom Jamie had called in for advice, was another fucking spiritual experience, and I have the perfect place, an abstinence-based rehab in the Montana wilderness. "I'm not going anywhere," said Christopher. "I hate the wilderness." "Then you can join the Asheville Transient Society," the counselor said. Christopher pleaded for help from his mom. Surely she would not abide him becoming homeless. But Jamie said she could no longer help Christopher finance an apartment, a car, a cell phone, or even food. "We're not enabling you anymore," she said. Instead, she spent a week in an Asheville hotel room with her dope sick son as he detoxed, toggling between a hot shower and the toilet, prepping for his return to rehab. A day into the detox, Christopher decided he was ready for another fucking spiritual experience. He was 20 years old. "I felt terrible," he remembered, "from Colton dying, and I knew I'd hurt my family a ton." He was tired of trawling for purses in mall parking lots when most of the car doors were locked. "I was not having enough money to get high. I'd been stealing too much, and I hated it. This time, I wanted it, sobriety, for myself." As of this writing, Christopher has remained sober 4 years. At 24, he's back in college, this time in Dallas, the city where he landed after Montana, to live in a sober house for young men transitioning from rehab to recovery. Offered a drink on his 21st birthday, Christopher told a waitress, "I'm allergic to alcohol." He was spending a lot of time giving back to the recovery community, he told me, mentoring young people who are newly sober, helping them work the 12 steps, and worrying about his mom as she increasingly devoted herself to helping other addicted people access treatment, calling rehabs, picking them up off the streets, and taking them to homeless shelters. His surgeon dad has even been known to give Jamie's cell phone out to addicted patients he meets in the ER. "There's a lot of emotional investment in it for her," Christopher said, "but she's not an addict, and she doesn't totally understand, still, that some of the people she deals with are going to die. And the small percentage of people who do end up getting better may end up relapsing," he added, "especially those who can't afford multiple rehabs and aftercare." How many addicts, after all, have moms who can afford not just to send their dope-sick son to a second $30,000 rehab, but also to accompany him on his flight to Montana so he won't, at the last minute, back out? Christopher knows he's in a rarefied position. Fewer than one quarter of heroin addicts who receive abstinence-only counseling and support remain clean 2 or more years. The recovery rate is higher, roughly 40% to 60%, among those who get counseling, support group, and medication-assisted treatment such as methadone, buprenorphine, or naltrexone. We know from other countries that when people stick with treatment, outcomes can be even better than 50%, Lemke, the addiction specialist, told me. But most people in the United States don't have access to good opioid addiction treatment, she said, acknowledging the plethora of cash-only MAT clinics that resemble pill mill pain clinics, as well as rehabs that remain staunchly anti-MAT. All told, Christopher had lost 4 close friends to opioid overdose, including Colton Banks and Scott Roth. For Brian, the number was also 4. "None of the recovering users I interviewed had been in the military, but they tallied their losses with the sorrowful stoicism of veterans who had been to war." Near the tail end of Spencer Mumpower's prison sentence, he had lost 12 friends, and 5 others were now in prison or jail. "He's had very few friends get clean, either through going to rehab or jail, but the ones who didn't are either dead or they have parents who enable them, and they continue to do drugs," his mother, Ginger Mumpower, said. "Most of his friends have never seen jail. They either talk their way out or their parents buy their way out." When Colton Banks died in 2012, for every 1 opioid overdose death, there were 130 opioid-dependent Americans who were still out there, still using the drugs. Chapter 7. Phoebe. In the picturesque Shenandoah Valley town of Woodstock, more than 2 hours north of Roanoke, bulk heroin cut in a Harlem lab had just made its way down I-81. It was the last thing Shenandoah County Sergeant Brent Lutz, a Woodstock native, would have expected to find himself doing, stalking a major heroin dealer. But here he was, at all hours of the day and night, clutching a pair of binoculars while crouched in the upstairs bedroom of his cousin's house a few miles outside of town. He'd spent so much time there in recent days that the mile-wide stench of chicken entrails coming from George's Chicken across the road no longer bothered him. Lutz was tracking the movements of Charles Smith and Pete Butler, suspected dealers in a newly arrived drug ring. Butler lived in a marigold-colored boarding house called Alma's, full of chicken processing plant employees, while Smith lived in a trailer park with his girlfriend behind the giant plant. Confidential informants had told Lutz that the men, former drug offenders who'd landed in town a year earlier to work at the plant via the Virginia Prison System's work release program, were responsible for the recent surge in heroin-related crime in Shenandoah County. Not only did Smith and Butler have dozens of people working under them, many of them addicted, they also had a boss. Over the next year, the story of that boss and his underlings would allow the young sergeant and his peers to pull the curtain back on the inner workings of a large-scale heroin ring for the first time. Across the nation, police chiefs and sheriffs were beginning to lament, "We can't arrest our way out of this epidemic." That sentiment illuminated the folly of the decades-long war on drugs, in which drug users are arrested 4 times more often than those who sell the drugs. Sergeant Lutz's government-financed odyssey would also illustrate just how expensive, difficult, and time-consuming enforcement strategies are, with $7.6 billion spent nationwide combating opioid-related crime in 2013 alone, compared with treating the addicted people who drive the demand. It was late 2012, and Lutz, 30, had just returned to his job as lead narcotics investigator from a temporary assignment elsewhere in the sheriff's department. Before he left, drug arrests in Woodstock, the county seat, were mostly related to black market opioid pills, Roxycodone or Roxy, Dilaudid, Percocet, and the like. His mother, a pharmacy assistant in the storied uptown drugstore with turquoise soda fountain counters and a handwritten charge account ledger like something out of Happy Days, had first warned him about pill abuse more than a decade before, sharing stories of customers who claimed they'd accidentally spilled their prescriptions down the bathroom sink. The local emergency room was by now accustomed to the classic fake and fraud. A moaning patient claiming kidney stone pain and pleading for Dilaudid, also known as that one that starts with a D. Drug-seeking behavior was so common that it spawned an Onion-style medical parody on a website called Gomer Blog, which punchy healthcare workers across the state had gleefully called to my attention. As one put it, to kick off their new labeling, the Dilaudid making company hopes to change the pain scale from 0 to 10 to Tylenol to that one that starts with a D, the satirist wrote. Farther out in the foothills of the George Washington National Forest, people were still making methamphetamine, Lutz knew. In 2008, he had worked a notorious case, arresting some 20 locals and diversion program inmates for smuggling meth-making materials out of George's Chicken via an elaborate pulley system dangling from the plant's roof. Lutz thought he had seen everything at George's Chicken, a plant manned by dislocated factory workers, young locals who lived just north of the poverty line, immigrants who'd managed to land a work visa, or a passable version of one, and an increasing number of workers whom Lutz referred to simply as diversion, as in, most of the trouble we get around here is from diversion, Lutz said. A Virginia Department of Corrections initiative, the program aims to divert nonviolent felons from prison to employment and to help them gain work experience that will ease the transition back to their communities after their sentences are complete. Most divertees hail from the urban centers of Roanoke, Richmond, and the Tidewater region, or outside Washington. Lutz had met with managers at George's Chicken numerous times. He said, "We're out there once a week at least. Fights, drug-related stuff, overdoses in the company parking lot. You ask them if they drug test, and they say they do, but I doubt they watch them, so they can still bring in clean urine. As long as they got people coming and going to work, they don't care." Lutz's boss, Shenandoah County Sheriff Tim Carter, told me the Department of Corrections was equally lax. He said, "They put these people in this program, but they don't put the resources to monitor them." A local probation officer, one of two overseeing the diversion workers at George's, told me she was lucky to check in with them once a month. Among the divertees who stay after their sentences are complete, very few of them earn enough money on their own to make expenses, so they either commit new crimes or they decide to give up and return back home, or they abscond. They run. The plant had become such a sore point among local police that Lutz and his colleagues joked, "Forget building a Mexican border wall. What they should really build is a wall around George's Chicken." But their rival bulk heroin in Woodstock was more proof that borders were impotent in the face of the drug. The weed killer Roundup may cure your front yard of crabgrass, but if your next door neighbor's lawn is infested with it, those weeds will eventually creep back into your turf. During the 6 months Lutz was away from his usual drug beat, heroin exploded in his tiny bucolic community. 3 people died of overdose, and the hospital would soon report its first opioid-dependent baby. Lutz said, "How it transformed from a pill problem to a heroin problem here, it was like cutting off and on a light switch." Local deputies had yet to identify the supplier of the dope, but an informant helped them zero in on people close to the dealer, including Smith and Butler, who were the eyes and ears of a major heroin supplier Lutz knew only by his nickname, D.C. In late 2012, D.C. was more rumor than reality, a malignant but murky force. A few counties to the east, an associate of D.C.'s selling heroin in Stafford County went by the nicknames Sonny and New York. In between the new heroin hotspots, local police were also noticing a spike in drug arrests and shoplifting. Lutz called in federal reinforcements when he heard the D.C., whoever he was in the habit of demanding sex from female addicts before he'd sell them their dope. Informants said at least one was a teenager. Lutz was also beginning to see former classmates hijacked by the drug. Farmer's kids, football stars, many of them still managing somehow to get up and go to work. One woman he knew was in the habit of kissing her husband goodbye in the morning, putting her kids on the school bus, then driving to Baltimore to buy enough to last the day before returning to Woodstock just as the school bus brought her kids home. Though Lutz had made his first undercover heroin buy in 2010, at a price twice the current going rate, Woodstock was now, 3 years later, beginning to fall prey to what economists would label the diseases of despair. Whereas central Appalachian communities like Lee County, victims of factory and coal mine shutdowns, followed by skyrocketing disability claims that made them prime sales targets for Big Pharma, had been battling opioid addiction since OxyContin's 1996 release, Woodstock and similar small towns were slower to experience deaths related to opioid addiction, alcohol-related liver disease, and suicide. They seemed to be somewhat shielded because their economies, while not exactly robust, had maintained a centuries-old agricultural base and were never dominated by a single industry or two, like so many smaller Appalachian counties where pill abuse first took root. The places with the lowest overdose mortality rates tend to be in farming-dependent counties with a more diversified economy, said Shannon Monat, a Syracuse University professor. She likened Woodstock to her hometown of Lowville, New York, a village near the Adirondacks that's economically dependent on dairy farming, wood products, and a wind farm that generates about $3.5 million a year for the local school district. Compared with Lee County at the western tip of Virginia, Woodstock and other rural communities like it displayed far better indicators of health. Fewer residents smoked, fewer were uninsured, and drug-related mortality rates were much lower than in places where single, labor-heavy industries like coal and furniture once dominated. More significantly, the opioid prescribing rate in the Woodstock region was almost half the state's rate, and less than one-third the rate of opioid prescriptions in the coalfield counties. On average, every person enrolled in Medicare Part D in Lee County had been handed a whopping 10.3 opioid prescriptions in 2013, compared with just 2.96 in Shenandoah County. As the epidemic spread from rural enclaves to cities and suburbs in the early aughts, police in Monat's upstate New York hometown began seeing the same trends as Sergeant Lutz. They were saying, "It's coming, we see traces, but it isn't here yet," she said. That doesn't mean people weren't self-medicating in other ways. It's just that alcohol doesn't kill you instantly like heroin and fentanyl can. As journalist Sam Canones theorized in his 2015 book Dreamland, maybe the addiction-prone people who would have succumbed to alcohol addiction in late middle age had opiates not appeared were the same people who are now prematurely dying of heroin in their early adulthood. Monat's deep dive into rural wellness data underscored that hunch. Binge drinking rates in the northern Shenandoah Valley were roughly the same, even a little higher, than rates for rural dwellers living in the nation's most distressed counties and towns. But people in their late teens and 20s didn't often die from booze. The real perfect storm fueling the opioid epidemic had been the collapse of work, followed by the rise in disability and its parallel pernicious twin, the flood of painkillers pushed by rapacious pharma companies and regulators who approved one opioid pill after another. Declining workforce participation wasn't just a rural problem anymore. It was everywhere, albeit to a lesser degree in areas with physicians who prescribe fewer opioids and higher rates of college graduates. As Monat put it, when work no longer becomes an option for people, what you have at the base is a structural problem where the American dream becomes a scam. She likened the epidemic spread not to crabgrass, but to a wildfire. If the economic collapse was the kindling in this epidemic, she said, the opiates were the spark that lit the fire, and the helicopters were nowhere in sight. By the spring of 2013, Lutz still didn't know DC's real name or what he looked like, but he had pieced together an impressive dossier of details. DC was African American in his mid-30s with no tattoos. He drove a silver, older model Mercedes SUV, nice but not too flashy, no custom rims. His heroin was said to enter Virginia's I-81 corridor in plastic Walmart bags, tucked inside snack containers carried by young women riding the Chinatown bus from New York, earning $300 to $500 per round trip. Packaged in Harlem, the heroin was shaped into uniform, 4-ounce, hockey puck-shaped discs that nestled snugly inside a Pringles can. Whoever was coordinating the production seemed to have a craving for a single flavor, cheddar cheese. And they were methodical, emptying the cans, then repacking them with 4 pucks and stacking a few Pringles at the end before resealing the tubes with a hot glue gun. The mystery source also seemed to crave Nilla wafers and Pepperidge Farm chocolate chip cookies, using those empty packages to transport powder cocaine, which Butler and Smith cooked into crack, Lutz later learned. An ex-offender who had long dealt in crack and marijuana, D.C. at first had no idea what to do with the Pringles pucks when they landed in Woodstock, so he hired Smith and Butler to break them down into dosage-sized units, or tenths of a gram. In fact, D.C. was so afraid of the drug that he wore rubber gloves, goggles, and a face mask while Smith and Butler cut and packaged the heroin into bags, called points, or tenths, on the other side of his living room. "He looked like he was doing surgery," one of his subordinate dealers told me. "He was way too scared of heroin to ever use it." Like many black heroin users and dealers, DC pronounced his product heroin, as in, "None of my friends or close associates does heroin. I wouldn't even know where to put the needle." But from the first moment he sent one of his subordinate dealers out in Woodstock to sell a gram's worth of heroin he'd paid $65 for in Harlem, and the dealer returned with $800 in cash, DC was hooked on another drug. "What you sell up in the city, you can double down your profits here," said an investigator on the case. "You don't have the competition in the small towns, and you don't have people shooting at you." Whereas commuter dealers running to Baltimore were bringing in 20 grams at most, DC's Pringles haul routinely contained 200 grams. Lutz crouched beneath the window, waiting for the Mercedes and thinking about his fiancée back home, still pissed that he'd been called out to work on Christmas Day. At a family wedding in Florida, he'd spent most of his time on his cell phone, monitoring an investigation of the latest overdose. When his cell phone rang at night, his fiancée's kids moaned loudly about him leaving, again, for work. As the county's point man for drug activity, he was now getting, on average, one phone call a night. Ever since the 2010 reformulation of OxyContin, Lutz had been tracking a small cluster of heroin users, most of them young white men, who made the 2-hour drive to Baltimore, a longtime heroin stronghold, on a near-daily basis. They buy enough to use, plus extra to sell to friends, making enough to fund both their next fix and gas for the trip to get the fix after that. Police classified them as commuter dealers, and they were becoming an important subset of the drug trade in Baltimore, where heroin sales were estimated at $1.5 million every day. For 40 years, Baltimore had been a prime staging area for dealers moving drugs, especially heroin, along the East Coast. Its port was an entryway for international drug smuggling. Another trafficking artery was Interstate 95, which connected Baltimore to cities from Miami to Bangor, Maine, with nicknames that transitioned over time, depending on the drug of choice, from Reefer Express to Cocaine Lane to the Heroin Highway, also called the Highway to Hell. With the highest per capita rate of heroin use in the country, Baltimore residents were 6 times more likely to die from an opioid overdose than the national average. Commuter dealers weren't making the trek just from Woodstock, but from nearby towns too, including Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland, localities that would both earn the nickname Little Baltimore for the explosions in heroin overdose deaths. A 2017 New Yorker profile of Martinsburg by Margaret Talbot opened with the synchronous thud of 2 Little League parents who had fallen from the bleachers after overdosing at their daughter's softball practice, their younger children running around and frantically screaming, "Wake up! Wake up!" 20-something Roanokers were drawing on drug dealing connections for their day-long northern treks up I-81 to New Jersey and New York. But in wide-open Baltimore, commuter dealers needed no such connection. When Shenandoah County native Dennis Painter made his first trip to Baltimore to buy heroin in 2012, he'd been advised simply to look for the blinking blue lights. Intended to aid police surveillance of high-crime neighborhoods, the lights also function as beacons for drug seekers with out-of-state plates. Dennis told me, "Sometimes the dealers will flash their lights at you when they see your plates. It's just crazy," he explained in a phone interview from a Nashville rehab facility in 2016. Then, once you know somebody to buy from, you just keep going back. And when the police arrest someone, there are four more people waiting.